Great. Hello, my name is Carly, and I'm a graduate student at the Massachusetts College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences in Boston. The CDC currently reports that 130 Americans die each day from an opioid-related overdose, and over 2 million Americans have been diagnosed with opioid use disorder. I'm working on a project alongside other students to bring attention to the work being done by individuals and organizations who are on the front line of the opioid epidemic. Our goal in this project is to shed light on the pivotal attempts to improve the health of our communities and the lives of those impacted by this healthcare crisis. Today, I would like to welcome Leonard Campanella to our podcast. Leonard is a former police chief of Gloucester and founder of PARI, the Police Assisted Addiction and Recovery Initiative. PARI is a nonprofit organization to help law enforcement agencies create non-arrest programs for opioid overdose and expand access to treatment and recovery. Welcome, Leonard. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Would you just mind sharing a little bit about your background and how you established PARI?
Sure. You know, I took over the chief's job in Gloucester in 2012. And while, you know, opioid issues are a problem in most communities, in Gloucester, we were seeing an increase of opioid related deaths, overdose deaths. And it really got to a point where in 2014-15, we're on par to double our yearly overdose deaths in that year. And you know, we were all kind of scratching our heads to see what we could do. You know, it was getting to a desperate situation. So we came up with an idea that would probably, you know, affect people on a number of levels. And it was called the Gloucester Angel Program. And what this was, you know, we basically were reaching out to the addicted community and saying, look, you know, we understand that this is more of a health problem than a criminal justice issue. And while the lines do cross, we don't feel like possession of an illegal drug should hinder our efforts to help in a recovery process for an individual suffering from addiction. So we invited people who were suffering from addiction to come to the police station if they needed help. And with or without their drugs and paraphernalia, they could turn those things over without threat of arrest or prosecution. And we would take that individual and usher them into a treatment program and then follow them, you know, as well as we could and offer them, you know, more services if they should relapse or something like that. It was a pretty bold initiative. We didn't really know how it would be received. In the end, it ended up being received overwhelmingly positively. We had put it out on social media. Within a couple of weeks, it had garnered about 2 million hits on Facebook, shared 20 million times over 60 countries, all of the states in the United States. And we were getting inundated with calls and people coming into the station. And we were able to really be effective in that. But what we realized pretty early on was that our program in Gloucester would need the support of, you know, a nonprofit entity to sort of take the weight off of our, what was a 60 person department, you know, fielding calls from the nation. So I reached out to a local businessman, Boston businessman, John Rosenthal, and asked him if he would be willing to partner with me and Gloucester in creating PARI, which was, you know, the Police Assisted Addiction Recovery Initiative. John's had experience with Stop Handgun Violence and Friends of Boston Homeless. He's done wonderful work there, and he luckily agreed and became our co-founder of PARI. And that was mainly set up as a clearinghouse for other police departments to receive information on treatment centers, receive information on our policies that we were developing, on how we were getting things done, and to act as sort of a support system. And as, you know, we started to receive some funding from government agencies, we had hoped to provide grants to police departments to start their own initiative, not necessarily the one that Gloucester had done, but something that would focus on taking the criminal prosecution or the criminal charges element out of the addiction issue and offering help. And so PARI developed, and you know, it was pretty successful. I think at the time I retired, we were in, you know, 500 or 600 police departments across the country, and They were partnering with PARI. There were thousands of other police departments who were adopting the strategy of looking at this as a health issue as opposed to a law enforcement issue, but one in which a law enforcement could assist in, because we crossed so many lines with these particular individuals. We came across them quite often. And so it really started changing the conversation, both, you know, at a local, state, and federal level. And that's, you know, that's where it's been since then.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay. So would you say that your goals from the beginning of the initiative were to, you know, alter the perceptions of the way we look at opioid use, and changing that from legal to medical? But what were some of your other goals throughout establishing this organization?
So, you know, when we started, it was really, you know, we had to kind of, you know, catch up with this train that we had put on the tracks and had left the station very quickly. And you know, with policy and things like that we were catching up with, our goals weren't very clear at the beginning. We knew we wanted to stem the tide of overdose deaths that we had, and that, you know, the traditional war on drugs, so to speak, was a complete waste of time and a failure. And the idea that prosecuting people into treatment could work was also a failure. You know, holding a jail sentence or a crime over their head with the condition that they go to treatment was a disaster. So we wanted to try something different. And immediately our goals were, you know, let's get these people into treatment as opposed to more access to drugs or into the criminal justice system. And, you know, by adding law enforcement's voice to this battle, I think we were able to reduce stigma, which across the spectrum of substance use disorder, I think that's a huge hurdle to try to bridge, because there's immediately doors being slammed in people's faces when you say, well, I'm addicted to a certain drug, or, you know, I'm having problems with opioids. A lot of people don't recognize that that's an illness, a disease, and not a failure of some moral or ethical issue that people are making judgment on. So by adding law enforcement to the mix on the side of the addiction community, I think we were able to help with that stigma, which is such a huge problem. And as we went on, you know, our goals became to help other police departments who were interested in developing their own programs in any way we could, by offering them, you know, the knowledge we had gained, or PARI's resources, and you know, that's been our goals. That was our goals.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, initiatives stemming from professionals, whether that's, you know, on the law enforcement or in the medical field, those initiatives really shape our communities in a way that fosters change, right? If law enforcement is advocating for it, then, you know, bystanders can advocate for it. And, you know, if it comes from a higher power, I think more people are open to the idea and accept it. And yeah, reducing stigma is one of the main goals of this, you know, to combat this opioid overdose crisis.
For better or worse, when you're standing there with a uniform and a badge on, people tend to listen a little more. And, you know, not making a judgment on whether that's right or wrong, but, you know, if you're being listened to, you know, you kind of have a responsibility to use your voice for something that you think will do the community good. And as I said, you know, this started out as let's try to bring our community to a more healthy point, a more inclusive point of people who are suffering from addiction.
Right. Absolutely. When you talk about funding or the resources that you have, how did your organization go about with developing funds, or even just providing resources, whether it be like Narcan or things, just the education portion of it?
Well, you know, I think in the beginning we were extremely lucky to have had such a social media impact and such a media in itself impact. We were very much a big story when we first got going, and that brings a lot of people who are interested in sort of the social justice of the program, if you will, or the edicts that it tries to strive for. And if people are on the same playing field, they're willing to invest in that. So we had anything from grants to public funding. You know, there was money out there in the government at the federal and state level that assisted with these type of diversionary programs, if you will. We also had private donors that issued grants at the beginning. We did some fundraising through the nonprofit side of that, and you know, funds did come in, and we were able to supply, you know, funding in very small amounts, maybe a couple thousand dollars of seed money to some police departments that needed that to even just get flyers out there. The interesting thing about Narcan is while we had this very national voice, you know, we questioned a lot of things that were going on. Why wasn't Narcan more available? Why was it $100 a dose? Why wasn't it in the hands of everybody who was suffering from this illness so that they had a measure to not die from it? And so the Narcan aspect of this was pretty amazing. We went from struggling to find Narcan to, you know, a newer company that was developing a different delivery system of Narcan to offering us 5,000 units that we shared with a number of police departments and passed out at community centers and things like that. And we also were successful, I think, at least in our area, with reducing the cost of Narcan significantly from, you know, hundreds of dollars down to maybe $15, $20 to $30 a dose, which was much more affordable for people to have. And now you see that, you know, Narcan is pretty common, that you can get your hands on just about anywhere, which is fabulous.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, even whether or not it actually becomes possible, but with the FDA or speculations about creating, you know, an over-the-counter Narcan would definitely benefit communities in the area. You know, just if everybody has the tools necessary to prevent an overdose, you know, we should have it in the hands of all of the high-risk individuals.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I think that that's only a matter of time. You know, everything moves slowly at the federal level. But I think the idea of having Narcan as an over-the-counter drug is, you know, absolutely fabulous. I think it's I think there's no detriment to people who don't need it or don't take it or take it accidentally. It certainly doesn't do anything to you if you're not using opioids and you mistakenly take it. So there's not a lot of downside to making it readily available.
Right. Absolutely. So when we talk about getting individuals into treatment or recovery, initially when you were first beginning this, what barriers did you encounter trying to get treatment and recovery options for people?
You know, historically the barriers, it was a very, you know, well-known phrase, there's no beds available, you know, and that was sort of a catchphrase for no treatment available. And I think the advantage that we had coming in very cold and very very fresh from a different angle is that, you know, law enforcement, again, for better or worse, we're not used to taking no for an answer. And when we developed a call list for the people that were coming into the station, a call list for treatment centers, it started off very small. And then it got bigger and bigger. And we realized that some of the traditional methods for people gaining access to treatment could be circumvented by our system. As you know, an example would be, you know, someone presents themselves to a hospital for treatment, that hospital only affiliates with certain treatment centers that are under the umbrella of that hospital group. And so those are the only offerings that were given to these individuals. Our system, we called everybody, and we continued to call and continued to call until we placed the person. So locally, you know, we had a list of about 30 treatment centers in Massachusetts that we could call for someone who, you know, either had insurance, didn't have insurance, you know, were on MassHealth or Medicare, any one of those systems. I mean, those are the natural barriers to this type of thing. What also happened was pretty amazing is that treatment centers from across the United States would call us and say, hey, look, we think you're doing great work. We'd love to give you 5 scholarships, you know, if you can get someone here. The price of a plane ticket will get them 45 days in treatment or 60 days in treatment. And so, you know, we were able to, you know, to work with those agencies as well.
Wow. That's incredible that, you know, you guys are being contacted by everyone else. You can just feel the momentum and the weight of the work you were doing. It's incredible. With that, I want to emphasize, you know, how successful you were. Can you talk a little bit about the White House Champions of Change?
You know, it was a pretty big surprise, and I think that it was I think that it was a testament to, we worked really hard in Gloucester. I mean, we were inundated at the beginning with people coming in for help. And the people, you know, the officers that let's start from the beginning.
To emphasize your successes here and, you know, the great work that has been done in Gloucester and throughout the nation, could you talk a little bit about the White House Champions of Change nomination?
Yeah, I think that was a big surprise. It was certainly, nice to be recognized because our officers in Gloucester were working really hard. In addition to all the regular duties that we did in order to keep the community safe, we had this new program, which was really taking up a lot of time. So it was nice to be recognized at that level. And there were eight other organizations in the United States that were honored as well for work in various topics. But, to get that kind of recognition was nice. And it also came with, contacts in Washington that we could call on for, chances at additional funding or resources or sort of, to work with in terms of policy change, of legislative change and things like that.
Yeah, definitely. It's all about connections, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah, it is.
I think, yeah, it's definitely difficult, and that's how things are hard to get kickstarted. But I think, it's very easy to underestimate the impact that, a single connection can make, or once you start something, like in your case with PARI, how fast the wheels start turning and how much speed and momentum it picks up even across the country. Like, I just think it's incredible. It's renowned. This work is significant, and it's definitely not stopping anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you get lucky enough to strike an idea that a lot of people are interested in and that worked really well for the time I was involved in it, you kind of have to be really committed to that and treat it really well and, just be happy that you were a small part of it when it was going, when you had the opportunity to do so. It was a lot of hard work, and it was took a lot of time and a lot of energy, and but it was the right thing to do. It always felt like the right thing to do, and so, we were really happy when a lot of other people felt the same way.
Absolutely, yeah, very timely, much needed initiatives. With that, how would you suggest for other, medical professionals, medical students, just any community members to get involved in initiatives like this? I mean, I'm sure with PARI, the doors are open, but do you have any suggestions of what people can or maybe should start advocating for or doing?
Yeah, well, I think the simplest thing they can do is become aware that this, whether or not it's palatable for them to think this way, this is a disease. It presents itself in the exact same way that other major diseases present themselves, like heart failure or cancer. And when someone with heart failure or cancer shows up at an emergency room or a healthcare facility and says, "I have this," whether or not people think that they had anything to do with it, for instance, a lung cancer person who smoked for 50 years, they don't get told, you started smoking and then it became an addiction and then it did this to your lungs, so we're not going to treat you. The same should be said for someone who's addicted. There's an addiction, there's an addiction scale here. Most addictions start with a legally prescribed opioid, a pill for pain or for some other reason. And the majority of people who start that way, there are a portion of them who move on and can't, physically, physiologically get out of the addiction cycle. And they end up with harder opioids and illegal opioids. And when those people present themselves in much the same way as other patients to a hospital, they often get told, "Well, here's your short-term 3-hour cure. Get out of the emergency room, or we can't do much else for you. We don't have any resources." That's never said to someone else who presents with a disease, ever. So, for people to just understand addiction in the same way they understand cancer or heart disease would be a great start, because I think that would open doors And I think, you know, I think that if people want to become involved, you know, everyone knows somebody or a family or a friend who knows somebody who is suffering from addiction. It's just that pervasive now. And Absolutely. A lot of the, and these are not people who are hiding under bridges. These are not people who are, you know, sticking dirty needles in their arms, you know, and stealing to get more money for drugs. You know, those are all stereotypes. In a lot of cases, these are people who, just like you or me, have a pretty good life, and, you know, mom and dad, and everything's going well, and they hit a bump with either an injury or something else, and mm-hmm. it's off to the races. So stigma is, I think, still remains the number one thing that people can reduce to get to be a part of this and to kind of continue to see things move forward.
Definitely. Yeah. Reducing stigma in our eyes, mine especially, one of the main goals we have to tackle if we're going to, you know, make progress, make any change. Without reducing the stigma or changing the way we talk about addiction or substance use disorder, we can do a lot of other things, but if we don't start there right at the core, it's kind of tough to envision a lot of other things falling into place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Leonard, I just, you know, I want to thank you for, one, taking the time to share your story with us, but also for all the work that you participated in and your support for PARI in the future, as well as for other organizations working to reduce stigma, advocate for safety and justice, and kind of, you know, embody unity throughout the states. How can we get the health of our communities back to where we need it? I want to thank you for speaking with us, and wish you the best of luck, wish PARI the best of luck, and we will definitely be doing our future research to see how we can, as students and as healthcare professionals and as faculty members, kind of initiate more change in the community.
Great. Well, thank you very much for reaching out and having me, and best of luck in the future, and continue on the good work you're doing there at Mass College of Pharmacy.
Oh, thanks, Leonard.
Okay.
Okay, so I actually have one more question for you. Do you have a professional photo or any photo that you wouldn't mind me posting with the blog bio?
I don't know if I still have those old pictures.
Yeah,
I can look and send it along.
No, it's totally fine.
Listen, if you Google my name and images, there'll be a ton of them.
Yeah. You don't mind me taking one? Okay, perfect.
No, you can take one.
All right. That's perfect. All right.
That's fine.
Well, thank you so much, Leonard.
Yeah, no problem. Good luck with it.
Thanks. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.